Wintrust Business Lunch. Here we go. I'm John Williams. Pete Zimmerman's the producer. So we talked a little bit last week. We're going to talk just a little bit more this week about how keeping meetings productive has changed a little bit, or maybe it hasn't, but they look different. And let's talk a little bit about counter offers. How do you keep talented people? Our first guest is Tom Gimbel, the founder and CEO at LaSalle Network, thelasallenetwork.com. Hi again, Tom.
Good morning, John Williams. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. It just turned that, and it really is. Nice day outside. Did you see it's going to get into the 80s, sir?
Summer has come.
I know.
Good times are abound, John.
You know, actually, it'll make it harder to do those Zoom meetings indoors. I mean, now the front door is right there. Maybe I'll just slip outside rather than stay at quote-unquote work while I'm working from home, Tom.
I'd say it's going to be a very different summer than last year when people weren't leaving their house and now meeting friends at Starbucks and having lunch outside on the patio and all of those things are in place. It's going to be a very different year.
Would you care as a boss where that person is doing their work? Is it okay if they're at Starbucks or out on the lawn?
Versus in their house, it doesn't matter. The question is when they're at Starbucks or they're out on the lawn, are they working or are they fraternizing? Are they socializing? Are they, at the end of the day, are they getting work done? Number one. Number two, is it building camaraderie and collegiality amongst their workers and the coworkers? And do you truly have a team versus a bunch of independent workers who work at the same place? And number three, are you getting the same output that you have gotten in the past? And that's really the issue that's up for grabs.
Well, I was actually thinking a little bit about that. So if meetings continue to happen over Zoom, even if I'm on the front lawn, has the meeting changed? What tips do you have to keeping them most productive?
Well, first and foremost, if you're working remotely and you like working remotely and you want to keep it that way, you've got to have your devices set up. Meaning if you're going to do your meetings on your iPad or your computer, then do them that way. The moment you start doing them on your phone from the park is the moment that your bosses and other people within your company are going to think that you're not really focused on work. And that's the biggest challenge that people have is, are you really in a pro work setting? So you've got to project that image, and hopefully it's an accurate image and it's not just something you're doing to keep the image out there. Mm-hmm. Number two is you can't be a stranger to the office. And the moment you view going into the office as a punishment rather than being able to work remotely as a perk, you're in the wrong frame of mind. So you've got to make sure that you still go into the office on a regular basis and that there is FaceTime, meaning not that you're brown nosing, but that they know that out of sight isn't out of mind. They're seeing you and you're building relationships with other people in the company.
I want to talk about counteroffers, but I just want to mention this from Fast Company. Speaking of meetings, they did an article, Fast Company, 4 times you should not schedule a meeting. And they are for a status update, anything without an agenda, anything with too many people, and brainstorming from scratch. Come prepared for somebody to work on something rather than say, let's just spend this time on Zoom and see what we can come up with. Do you agree or disagree with that list?
No, I disagree to an extent. I think that if you know what you're, if the leader of the meeting knows what they're trying to accomplish, that missing some of those is fine. What we have right now with people working remotely is actually, it's a positive time to be having a meeting for meeting's sake because you want people to have time to BS together and to have water cooler-ish gossip together.
Really?
Because otherwise they're not getting that. You need to provide that forum in remote learning, so remote work environment. So to avoid having a meeting for meeting's sake is a big mistake.
Many employers are offering counter offers to keep their talent. What does that mean? Somebody's hiring me away. I tell my boss, listen, Smith Company's going to give me $10 more. What have you got? Is that what happens?
Yeah, you hit the nail right on the head of saying, you know what, John, I really don't want to leave. However, this company called me up. They created an opportunity, and it pays this, and I'm curious if there's some flexibility. Now, you have to be very careful because if you're gonna call someone's bluff, you have to be ready to walk away. But we're seeing more now than ever that in this war for talent and with unemployment being so low, the companies are giving counter offers and they realize that just because I'm a little bit late to the party doesn't mean I don't value you and I'm happy to meet that match. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
I wonder if you should be proactive. Hey, Mr. Employer, if you've got somebody good don't wait for somebody to come headhunting for them. Go ahead and sweeten the pot right now.
Well, there's a lot of meaning to that, John, and I think that you're not off. You have to realize that there's the value that the employee has to your company. There's the value that they have to a competitor or just any other company on the street. And then there's the value that they think they're worth in their own brain. And you've got to, as an employer, you've got to balance those three and make sure that you're paying appropriately. And there's one thing to be paying people fairly, and there's another to try to bribe people to stay at a position that they're not happy in.
Yeah, that's a good point, too. Maybe it's best for them and the company if they go. One last thing, then. Is it cash we're talking about, or are there other perks that you retain them with?
In this day and age, it's really cash because the perks are, you know, it used to be bring your dog to work, wear flip-flops, and have flexible schedule. And now, so because of the employment situation and the economy, that's almost for everybody to be able to work from home. So now it's cash compensation and then what I really call accountability. And that is, are you putting people in a challenging work environment, no matter where they're working, and holding them to deadlines and learning new skill sets where they feel that they're being challenged in a way at your place that they're not going to get someplace else?
Tom Gimbel is the founder and CEO of LaSalle Network, thelasallenetwork.com. Thanks, Tom.
Stay healthy, John. Talk to you soon.
Philip Weiss joins us again, the president of Cyfarth at Work, cyfarth.com. I'll give you the spelling of that in just a second. But, Philip, last week we were talking about meetings, as we were a moment ago with Tom Gimbel from LaSalle Network, and about the value of keeping them brief. You recall that conversation, right?
Absolutely. And it's interesting because we're with people coming back to work in different forms, with people re-meeting live for the first time, there's a lot of focus on how much talk is really valuable in the workplace. And what we've found, and something that's worth remembering right now, is that quite often, whether you're dealing with a sales situation, a manager, an employee, less is more and brief is often best.
Less is more, brief is best. Yeah, I guess we knew that. Maybe it's one thing to know that and another thing to do that, huh?
That's exactly right. The science is one thing because it's about making it real and making it happen in the workplace. But there's been a lot of research behind what's called cognitive fluency. And what cognitive fluency basically focuses on is the fact that when we hear something that is easy, quick, succinct, and can be applied, we're much more comfortable acting on it. And that sounds great in theory, but the practice is where the rubber meets the road. There was some research out of MIT and NYU that found that even when companies, startup companies, had a shorter name that was easy to pronounce, that alone equated to higher stock price and better performance when you controlled for other factors. We see that in the workplace as well. People do better who can encapsulate. Managers who can reduce their feedback for their employees from two paragraphs to three or four lines will get better results after the meeting. So there's a lot of great science and great practical results from doing it.
The challenge must be, though, in that if you're trying to convey something important and you're very brief, won't they interpret that as being, well, not that important? He only talked about it for 3 or 4 minutes and not 15 minutes.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, there is this balancing act. Part of it is reading people's reactions, meaning it's not only about the talk, it's about what we see. If people grasp what we're saying, if they're nodding along, we know we can move along in the discussion. Part of it has to do with what we call giving other people the floor, meaning let them engage with what you're saying to a point where they can grapple with it and they can embrace the point, whether you're trying to convince someone to buy a product or to buy into a project if you're the manager in the workplace. So there's the whole idea of having almost like an elevator pitch for critical conversations, but also giving other people the floor so they can engage with you. That allows you to make sure you have enough time, but you also are not overplaying your cards.
Were they practicing brevity, maybe they would have not had some of the problems they did at base camp, right? You don't
That's
have
right.
to edit for content if you just edit.
That is exactly right. And, you know, we see it across situations, industries. We were working with a sales group, and there were a number of guys on this team and women on this team who were not able to move up the ladder. And what we found to a person is when they were doing a sale, they just did not know when to self-edit, as you said. One gentleman, in fact, he would be with a client talking about a computer program, and when the client or customer was starting to discuss on their side of the table, how will we pay for this? How will we manage the finances? He couldn't help himself. He offered suggestions. We have companies that take loans. We have companies that spread the cost. But he found, looking back, that by offering all that additional information, he actually confused the discussion, ended up with companies either delaying or reducing the purchase. So if somebody's already buying in and figuring out what to do with your point, your elevator point is working, you do want to take a step back. And managers behind closed doors, they will tell us, our employees talk too much. We don't want to chill them, but they talk too much about the personal, about the gripes. We want them to learn this skill because we will promote them faster if they can talk in a more succinct fashion.
Have you been on sales calls where you see somebody and they're talking themselves right out of the sale? I've been in meetings where I thought, I think you should stop now. I don't think you need to keep selling it or keep affirming it. They've got it.
Yeah. It is an incredibly uncomfortable moment when you're that third person and you see the deal derailing, going sideways. In another prime example of what you're talking about, there was a branding company, and the sale was just about across the finish line, and one of the buyers started to actually champion the sale, say, let's go with this, but he mischaracterized part of the solution, and the salesperson corrected the buyer in that one moment, just trying to make sure that the buyer understood everything about the deal, but that was enough to shut this guy up. He was no longer an advocate, and the deal suffered. So you're right. Those moments are the critical moments, and managers tell us in our own workplace, employees don't know when they're in that critical moment where they should sit back, listen, and absorb what they're hearing as opposed to just continuing to talk about their opinion.
I wonder if the reverse, what do you say about the flip? So it's not working. You've done a good job. It's not happening. Any strategies then?
Yeah. Well, that takes some sort of pre-planning as well, because you want to be ready for the objections. And that's something managers have also told us and CEOs also told us behind closed doors, which is our employees who come to us with an issue or a suggestion, and they've got to be ready for our objections because we've seen a lot more than they have. But if they basically embody what our goals, if they articulate our vision and they are ready for a couple of objections, we're more likely to think through the solution with them. So you want to be pithy, but you want to be problem and solution focused. So it's not about not being ready to talk. It's about knowing where to focus your energies and your preparation with that kind of elevator point and giving others the floor at the same time.
Philip Weiss is the president of Seyfarth at Work, SEYFARTH, Seyfarth.com. Philip, we'll talk again. As always, a pleasure.
Pleasure as well. Thank you, John.
23 days. That's how many more days we have to keep the pandemic in check. And then we're at phase five. And that means 40,000 people at Wrigley Field. That means Lollapalooza without a mask. That means restaurants at full capacity. 23 days. So I wonder what that means for the real estate market, too. I mean, that's you and I spending a little cash and getting elbow to elbow with folks. But does that change the real estate market? Does that change people's desire to come downtown? David Wolf is the president and CEO at Wolf Development Strategies. Hi, David. You're on WGN Radio.
Hi, John. How are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm good. Thanks for asking. We're doing well here, too. I visited with Dr. Ngozi Ezike earlier on the show, and I said, is that right? It's like there was no pandemic. And she said, that's correct. She said they've even baked into that calculation with confidence the fact that some people won't be wearing a mask and have not been vaccinated. So it's real as long as we behave for the next 3 weeks. I'll bet you're pretty excited about that, too.
We are all very excited about it.
How does that change your world then? I mean, you're residential development, right?
Correct. We represent developers of for-sale housing typically, so large-scale condo developments in urban markets. We're based in Chicago, so a lot of our business is here, but we're operating in other markets across the country.
What's been going on in those kind of units in the city of Chicago in the last 13 months?
It's interesting because when the pandemic first started, when the shutdowns first happened, what we do is we sell properties that typically don't exist yet, right? They're about to be built. So we actually noticed that people cared more about where they lived and the floor plan and being able to work from home and outdoor space and things like that. So our business actually started to pick up, and we did see some of the flight to the suburbs, and we felt from the beginning that it would be temporary. And because, you know, remember, before the pandemic happened or started, there was this urban migration trend. And so we felt like it would be temporary. And it happened. There were some people that moved out and some people that moved up their timeline to move to the burbs, for instance, people that were starting families, things like that. But we noticed as of the second half or the more recent months that demand has really shot up for large-scale apartment buildings, condo buildings, and regular, you know, residential single-family homes. People are moving back to the city, and, you know, anecdotally, we don't have a lot of the data yet on what's trended over the last 90 days, but everybody's very busy, and it's a good sign that there's a lot of demand.
Anecdotally, I'm 18 stories up. I'm looking out my window, and I'm looking at some empty condo units downtown right on the river. I mean, on the other side of my building is the Genie Gang building, for crying out loud. This is prime real estate. I hope you're right, but I don't – the downtown, right? The Loop is not busy right now.
Downtown is going to be the last to come back. I would say downtown high-rise is, and I'm talking like the Loop, Lakeshore East, some of those areas, they're starting to pick up in traffic. If you look at some of the traffic at the Lakeshore East properties, they're busy. What the bigger issue was for traffic and real estate demand was more of the political unrest, civil unrest, than it was COVID. However, we are kind of seeing a rolling demand come from basically, you know, outskirt neighborhoods, smaller properties, back to mid-sized properties, down, you know, up to the high-rise, denser properties. I mean, we're marketing something right now in Printer's Row, you know, 43-story new construction building, and traffic is very, very busy. It won't deliver for, you know, two and a half years, but people are not afraid to live in that type of environment.
I'm really glad you said what you did. I think that the pandemic we could not control. That is, it was a virus, it was inevitable, and we could only manage it. One thing I think we can better control is crime or the perception of safety in the city. That's something for our city fathers and police and the mayor and those sorts of folks to ensure that people feel good about coming downtown and living downtown. And I'm an advocate, but I think that's the work that's cut out for them, don't you think?
I totally agree. I think when you think about the city, you know, we don't live in a place that's known for great weather. Because of that lack of great weather, we have amazing amenities. We have great entertainment, restaurants, outdoor things you can do in good and bad weather.
Yep.
And when those amenities are taken away, you kind of lose the reason or the benefit to living in the city. And if you don't feel safe, that's the key to all of it. So we're starting to see people feeling safer, people that are advocating for getting back to help the city become what it was again.
Yeah.
And there's some real momentum. I would say post-election is when we really started to see the momentum happening. And I don't think it's a political statement, meaning, you know, whether you were Trump or Biden. I think it's more some of that's behind us and we're able to move forward. And we really saw a spike in demand and sentiment of buyers and renters and even developers thinking about future projects.
Well, sell me something. Okay, I'm going to come in. I'm going to live in a condo in the city. Where are you going to put me?
So right now we have two active projects that are good examples. One is 1400 West Monroe, which is in the right across from Skinner School in the West Loop. Right, so you have a lot of green space around you. It's a seven-story building, not very dense, low-amenity building. But we're getting a lot of families, a lot of people that are actually empty nesting. They live in a house in Lincoln Park, and they want to live in the hottest neighborhood in Chicago, which is the West Loop, but they don't want to be right in the heart of everything. We're getting a lot of that. So the demographics are older millennials and boomers and, you know, empty nesters and kind of everybody in between. And then we have a project that we just started. Now, by the way, that project starts to deliver this September. So the demand is really increased for people that are saying, hey, now this is on the radar. As I look at other resale properties, this is something that I can live in the next, you know, 4 months, right? The other property is a larger, you know, 43-story building. It's a vertically subdivided building, so you have condo property on top of rental property, and we're getting significant demand. But these are COVID-friendly amenities. I mean, some of these designs that you're hearing about that are talked about as COVID-friendly were actually in process or in play well before the pandemic, because there had been this trend of communal everything and high density, small unit, but great, you know, amenities for the residents. And people started to tire of that a little bit. So we've really been able to create an environment where you can be with everybody or you can be separate. And that's where the trend is going, in my opinion. And wellness, health, all of those things were trending pre-COVID, but now they're really in the forefront because of what happened with the pandemic.
Do people want a health facility in their buildings then? You know, health club, exercise room, that sort of thing?
They definitely want that, but they also want air purification systems. They want the ability to do things touchless, remote, apps that control everything. They want to be able to have a private yoga class, but also be in the gym with everybody if they feel like it. They want to go to the pool, but have a private section if you wanted to reserve a cabana. And they want outdoor space and green space. So a lot, you'll see a lot of buildings are integrating parks or, you know, more. There's more focus on health, wellness as mm-hmm. part of the lifestyle. And I think that's been important for a long time, and I think you're seeing it. And we're seeing it in other buildings, too, where you know, there's a building in Miami where the amenity is a complete wellness and medical facility as an amenity to the building.
Huh. Well, okay, I'm going to do that. I'm going to move into both of those buildings you just described here in Chicago. Do I go to Wolf Development at wolfdev.com to sort of get the 411 on that, David?
Sure. We don't typically sell from our website. It's really more about our work, but wolfdev.com can take you to the website for all of our projects.
I should talk to you, David. Good luck and continued success. I like your positivity. David Wolf, the president and CEO of Wolf Development Strategies. It's wolfdev.com. Thank you, sir. It's 12:44. Steve Krasanich has more business news on the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. There's yet another development being planned for the Fulton Market District in Chicago. This one is a 1.1 million square foot proposal called Fulton Square, including apartments and offices. The project will include nearly half of the 1,200 block of Fulton Street, bounded by Racine and Carroll Avenues and Elizabeth Street. The plan includes two apartment buildings with 600 units and a 500,000-square-foot office building. Other developers recently announced projects including two life sciences lab buildings and an office building. There's a new unicorn in Chicago. The fintech startup Amount has raised $100 million in new funding, and its valuation now exceeds $1 billion. Amount has 350 employees in Chicago and 400 overall. The UK-based Barclays recently tapped Amount to operate the bank's new Buy Now, Pay Later product for U.S. merchants. Amount provides technical capabilities for financial institutions. I'm Steve Grisanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Business of food. Here's Steve Alexander.
Yep, let's give a salute to Midwest corn farmers. Are you old enough to remember that Hee-Haw TV show and the cornfield salute? Anyway, our overachieving farmers are planting like prices are the highest they've been in 13 years, which they are. The Illinois corn crop is 86% planted compared with the average of 71%. Iowa's at 94% compared to 81% average. Wisconsin's at 78% in. The average is 55. Michigan's way ahead of average at 70% compared to 38. Indiana's trailing with 62% of the corn in the ground. The average for the Hoosiers is 54%. Some of your garden planting may still not be done. Maybe too early? Maybe not. Our gardening guru, Jim Fizell, says he isn't too worried about frost anymore.
Maybe a 5% chance of frost, but I think the long-range forecast is for 80s, and I really seriously doubt we're going to have any more frost if it's going to be 80 every day. The old-timers always did say that your last frost would be the full moon in May, which is the 26th this year. I don't think we need to pay any attention to that. The big problem right now is water. Too much water. 2 inches plus in some of the areas south of the city last week. And there's some places where there's not enough. Our rain gauges have been dry most of the spring. Actually, March was pretty wet. We had 4 inches of water, and that was pretty close to normal, slightly above. But April, we had a little over a half inch of water in our rain gauges. And so far this month, we've only had a quarter of an inch. If you're in a wet place, don't rush out to work the soil. Wait until the soil is dry enough or you'll mess it up. If you're in a dry place, be sure that you get out and water. Plants need about an inch of water every week. especially newly planted stuff like the trees or lawns, if you sodded, in your vegetable and in your flower garden as well. You need to put some water on those if you want to protect those plants to get them to perform as you'd like them to.
Mr. Fizz, Jim Fizzell, he'll be back again tomorrow with some tips on what to do in your garden. Big volatility again today at the Chicago Board of Trade. Soybeans are right now down about 14 cents at $15.73 a bushel. Corn is now up a penny at $6.54, and wheat is down about a nickel at $6.94 and a quarter. Today's Farm to Your Belly feature, it is courtesy of the Dairy, Egg, and Grain Farmers. It is National Cheese Soufflé Day. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch talks about cruising. Hi, Amy. How are you?
Hi, John. How's it going today?
Good. So what's Carnival for One up to?
Yeah, so, you know, we saw a lot of conversation around cruise lines earlier in the pandemic cycle, you know, tight quarters, a lot of people in one kind of confined space. So obviously there was a lot of people thinking about how to do that safely. Eventually there was a no sail order issued, but Carnival has been in talks with the CDC and they say that they're working towards restarting sailing in July. That was a comment that the Carnival president said yesterday. So, you know, where it comes down to, I think, is a place where a lot of businesses are really struggling right now is the idea of how do you prove that people are vaccinated? So the CDC has said that cruise ships could resume open water sailing if 98% of crew members and 95% of passengers are fully vaccinated. But of course, you know, that presents many logistics questions. But I think it will be interesting to see how this conversation goes and what comes of it. Carnival is the largest cruise corporation in the world by revenue. They make about $8 billion annually. So it's that's a pretty big operation to be sidelined by the pandemic. There's, you know, of course, so many businesses that have been impacted. This is just one of them. But I think it will be interesting, two things. One, to see how this conversation goes. And the other one, to see what is the appetite for cruise travel at this moment as we're trying to emerge from the pandemic.
Those numbers are pretty impressive, though, 95% and 98%. So on a ship of, let's do the math on that. That's 1 in 100 could be infected, say, or at least not vaccinated. So if you've got a ship of 4,000, what's that, 40 people, and everybody else is vaccinated, that sounds pretty safe to me.
Yeah. So I think it's just a matter of how do they, you know, prove that? How can you prove that you're vaccinated? Yeah. How does that work?
Yeah. No kidding. Although, you know, we're leading a trip with Kelly Cruises. That's not Carnival, but that ship's just 150 people in October down the Rhine. Visit kellycruises.com. So for the 150 people that will be on that boat, passengers, if they adhere to the same thing, that would mean one or two people total could get on as a passenger who have not been fully vaccinated. That's a really stringent number. But again, I think that's very comforting to those of us that are going to be on that boat.
Yeah. And, you know, when you think about just the tight quarters of a cruise ship and just how many people are in one spot, I think it makes sense to probably have a little bit higher standard of that.
Yeah. Talk to me about Walmart. What's going on there?
Yeah. So we've seen some first quarter earnings coming in, and I'm always very interested in some of those big box stores. So many people kind of leaned on them during the pandemic. Walmart sales, they raised their annual earnings forecast earlier today. The results were better than expected, so better than Wall Street anticipated. So the sales were up about 6%. Still, that's slowing from 8.6% increase in the fourth quarter. So people are shopping less at Walmart, but still, it's still up from last year. That was about a 10% spike earlier, you know, last year, but still, 6% up and beating Wall Street expectations. Always interesting to see and how that goes. And Home Depot essentially did the same thing. Home Depot, you and I have talked about how a lot of people were leaning on, you know, do-it-yourself kind of projects for a couple reasons. One of them, their home. They realized, you know, now's the time I'm going to fix that thing that's been bothering me. And or people perhaps were less inclined to have a worker come into their house to fix something. So there was more DIY projects. So we saw some Q1 results from Home Depot that also beat analyst projections. Their sales were $37.5 billion. That's up 32.7% What was projected was 34.88. So they hit 37.5. So that's a pretty big indicator there. Their profit nearly doubled, hitting $4.1 billion. So that's about $3.86 per share. That compares with about $2.08 per share a year ago.
I think they did $37 billion at the one on Ashland this weekend.
I know.
Have you been to a Home Depot lately? They're making money, let me tell you.
Yeah, I went to one about a month ago, and it was very, very crowded with people. So I thought, yeah, they're probably doing okay.
Especially now that the greenhouse is open or the garden center. So folks are just, they cannot move the mulch and dirt and plants fast enough. One other quick note here. Talk to me about Lamborghini.
Yeah, so obviously this is a story that affects us all because we all are in that price range. And so Lamborghini announced earlier today that it is planning to launch a fully electric vehicle by, they said, before 2030. They are, you know, they've rolled out this kind of big transformation program. They want to, they called it a roadmap to the decarbonization of future Lamborghini models. They said in the next 10 years, the company is going to transition to hybrid models, and they're going to start doing that pretty soon before it launches this fully electric car. So I think it'll be really interesting to see what Lamborghini comes up with. Again, not maybe something we're all just going to rush out and buy, but always interesting to see what these, you know, the big high-end cars are up to.
World is changing right before our eyes. All right, that's Amy Guth. We'll visit again. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.